School closures, layoffs, sickness, and lockdowns. We're facing unprecedented restrictions and hardships, uncertainty and frustration. As it is so often the case in times of crisis, the stories of everyday folks doing extraordinary things to help their communities aren't rare. It is inspiring so many people are coming forward to help, and that's how we're going to beat this back. How well we succeed will be measured by how well we handle the adversity. Today is April the 22nd, 2020. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. Zoom has a security problem. Well, that we all know. Last week saw the U.S. Senate join the ever-growing chorus of federal officials advising staff against using Zoom. Teens are now trolling members of Congress. It turns out in many cases, at least, it's just a bit of clever Googling. More worrisome, the same search tactics for finding Zoom calls can apply to the company's product specifically built for government use. But as most of the kiddie culprits behind these sorts of attacks will tell you, it's ridiculously easy to find Zoom meetings to trash. And from a little bit of analysis, that adage doesn't just go for calls held in classrooms, but also for those held on Capitol Hill. Attacks on local governments have been happening for weeks. Trolls have reportedly descended on city council meetings, happening across pretty much every state you can name. In response to these attacks and others, Zoom beefed up its security practices, giving each meeting a virtual waiting room by default, allowing hosts to pre-screen potential participants and boot out any obvious trolls. With very little effort, you would be able to figure out how a lot of these kids were finding these codes to begin with. The overwhelming majority comes from teen and teenage students just passing their own class codes among themselves to screw around with teachers. A few of the enterprising types created scrapers or bots to mine or invites to Zoom meetings off of major social platforms. Another popular method, as it turns out, is Google dorking, essentially using certain keywords in Google's search bar to dredge up vulnerable intel from the web. Dork, as these keywords are called, aren't just the bread and butter of hacking aficionados or cyber criminals, but of certain investigative researchers, which means that you could theoretically hack into the same congressional meetings these teens were a part of. Unless you take a few extra steps to bury stuff from the search engines like Google, just about everything you post online is indexed and stored in a searchable digital record. When it comes to sites run by folks that are a tinge less tech-savvy, like, say, the website of a given local government, knowing the right words to search can turn up anything from the site's entire history, even if it's hidden behind some sort of password protector. All public-facing Zoom links share a similar searchable string, making it easy to find an endless upcoming meetings that have been posted somewhere online. A spokesman for the company said, "Zoom takes security extremely seriously. Zoom is aware that in some instances where users have shared links to meetings publicly, they may be indexed by search engines, and they are working hard to de-index those links and have the results taken down." The spokesperson also added that they strongly encourage all users to not post links to sensitive meetings on public websites, and they recommend the use of password protection and virtual waiting rooms to ensure uninvited users are not able to join. Counterfeit Intel CPUs are doing the rounds in China. Third-party sellers and shopkeepers, RMA or CPUs, modified integrated heat spreader and no dies. Counterfeit and fake CPU scams have been going on for years, and usually it's customers who have been victim to these illegal activities. However, in a new report, it looks like even the major tech companies are falling prey to these. In the report, it is mentioned that China-based shopkeepers and third-party resellers have been trying to RMA massive amounts of counterfeit Intel CPUs directly to Intel, to which Intel has advised customers to be aware of such activities and try to buy their CPUs from official channels. Counterfeit Intel CPUs doing the rounds in China through third-party resellers and shopkeepers has been acknowledged by Intel rise in RMA scams. Intel and AMD counterfeit CPUs have been circulating the retail and used processor market for years. The main scam is when third-party resellers try to sell buyers a CPU that isn't similar to the one they had ordered. This can be achieved in many ways, with most common example being the integrated heat spreader, which sits on top of the CPU die, bears critical information of the CPU itself, such as the processor name, number, spec code, clock speed, and batch number. The spreader also carries the official logo. And that's one reason why we do not recommend buying used equipment or refurbished equipment from other than the manufacturer themselves or from someone who you know that is selling you the genuine stuff. Because with used equipment and the heat sink covering the CPU, you don't know. By the way, there is a way of identifying the true CPU itself, and I'll go through this later. The integrated heat spreader can be removed and modified in two ways. Either scammer keeps the same integrated heat spreader and put it on older generation CPU, or they can modify the integrated heat spreader itself, which is usually a more complicated process made easy these days through several integrated heat spreader stickers that are readily available in the market, put on top of the integrated heat spreader information on the CPU itself. The second way requires no change in the integrated heat spreader, but those who don't double check can easily be fooled by such CPUs. An official Intel Core desktop processor should have the following official labels as per the company standards to be RMA. While customers have been main victims of such tactics, the source reports that even Intel China has acknowledged and issued a statement on these counterfeit CPUs. As per Intel, several shopkeepers and third-party resellers have submitted tampered CPUs for RMAs with new processors. The CPUs come with false trademarks and information printed over the CPUs. In other words, with the older CPUs have been covered over with false information indicating that it's a new CPU. There have also been CPUs that come with modified printed circuit boards, and that was also a new scam ongoing in the Chinese market, with scammers selling 8th and 9th generation CPUs with printed circuit boards with a current pin layout, but didn't feature any CPU die on the printed circuit board. The 2D matrix, which contains the serial code of the processor and the 3rd, 4th, and 5th digit serial numbers on the printed circuit board, has also been modified to match that of the new CPU. Intel said that they won't only refuse the RMA warranty process for such CPUs, but can also take legal action against the sellers of these CPUs. The number of counterfeit CPU is reported by Intel to be very large, and these sellers can potentially sell these CPUs in the online market for very high prices, as there's an evident shortage of 8th and 9th generation Intel CPUs. If you bought a refurbished unit other than from the manufacturer themselves, how do you know what you have? Simple. In the operating system, you go to Control Panel, System, and right there, it tells you what the processor is in detail. Hopefully, you've gotten a genuine processor with the system you bought. Stay-at-home computing projects. In this period of stay-at-home, it gives me some time to catch up on some of the out-of-mainstream computing projects. For me, there are two platforms that has always caught my interest. It is the Raspberry Pi and the Chromebook. Sales of Raspberry Pi single-board computers hit 640,000 in March, the second biggest month for sales since they started selling it, as consumers flocked to inexpensive ways to work, and learn from home. In the early days of personal computing, desktop units were more adaptable to be modified. You can easily change the CPU processor on the same motherboard. You can overclock the CPU to increase the speed of the processor. You can easily pop in different hard disk peripherals with different operating systems without the need to open the chassis. You were able to pop disk drives in and out like floppy diskettes. What is the equivalent for such a platform today? The Raspberry Pi enables the do-it-yourself hobbyist to adapt a unit to fit different uses. The Raspberry Pi can be used to edit documents, use the web, use Gmail and Office 365, and all the baseline use cases of a general-purpose computer. Other uses of Raspberry Pi computers have been related to the COVID-19 outbreak. For example, efforts are underway to get ventilators running on Pi computers, which, if successful, could help address the shortage of traditional ventilator equipment. Outside of ventilators, the pandemic have highlighted shortages in personal protective equipment, that's PPE. 3D printing manufacturers and hobbyists have been building face shields printed on plastic acetate that can be easily assembled and delivered to hospitals for free. The Raspberry Pi has become the most popular platform for managing 3D printers. A Raspberry Pi project that I've tinkered with is PiHole, that's P-I-H-O-L-E. PiHole is a network-wide ad blocker. Instead of installing ad blockers on every device and every browser, you can install PiHole once on your network, and it will protect all of your devices because it works differently than a browser-based ad blocker. PiHole also blocks ads in non-traditional places, such as in games and on smart TVs. Using the Raspberry Pi Zero, the total cost was under $20. Another Raspberry Pi project I have on the docket is Raspberry Pi VPN server. As reported, many VPN offerings may secure your data, but the issue of privacy is always in question when it comes to the use of the data. Pi VPN is a lightweight, open VPN server designed to run on Raspberry Pi 2 or 3. Gives you access to your home network through a secure connection over the internet. By plugging a Raspberry Pi into your router, it acts somewhat like a bridge between mobile devices and your network. One-click VPN services can be great, and there are VPNs if you want a simple solution that works out of the box. That service comes with a cost usually about $5 to $10 a month, not to mention putting your trust in whoever's on the other end. For a cheaper option that you control, you can set up an open VPN server on a Raspberry Pi and use your home internet connection as a VPN while you're out and about. Well, on the other platform of interest to me is the Chromebook. The ready availability to factory reset without losing the application and the associated data which resides in the cloud. With the Windows PC, factory reset, well, you can do it and yet still be able to maintain and store applications and associated data, but it's not a simple task. The newer Chromebooks can now run Android applications, which can bridge the use of the smartphone to the computing laptop. Being a senior citizen, running Android apps on a smartphone is not easy on the eyes. A major feature is one that almost is never mentioned, and that is a basic backup of your app and data in the cloud. Most people, unfortunately, still do not back up their system in the event of the need to restore. I decided to get a Chromebook that runs Android apps. I went shopping for a Chromebook. Wow, it was a shock. There's a shortage of Chromebooks. Many outlets are just plain out of stock. To squeeze the supply of Chromebooks, iPads, and other digital learning devices. In late March, the chief technology officer for the Boston Public Schools had a huge pallet of brand new Chromebooks for volunteers to deliver to families across the city. It was part of a massive initiative to quickly distribute 20,000 laptops to Boston K-12 students. Each device purchased weeks earlier in response to a widening coronavirus outbreak that at the time had yet to shut down most of the nation's schools indefinitely. They realized they had to get more computers in the hands of students to use at home, noting the plan was to make use of available laptops the district already owned. But as the disease tightened its grip, upending daily life for hundreds of millions of people domestically, the district shifted to plan for a prolonged closure and new devices would need to be acquired. By then, they had to place an order or else large districts are going to quickly buy up all remaining inventory. Everybody's fighting for them, in demand for new devices among K-12 schools. They had some districts reach out to them asking if they could buy some of the units that they just bought. The scene from Boston, panic-induced district technology acquisition highlighted by a plethora of new mobile devices that need to be distributed in a flash to support on-the-fly remote learning strategies, is unfolding across the rest of the country. Chromebooks, the device of choice for most school districts, along with other laptops and tablets, are in short supply, according to many analysts. The uptick in school district device purchases comes as Chinese-based supply chain that builds mobile computers and electronic components has yet to fully recover from a coronavirus wave that ravaged its country for months earlier this year. And with some form of remote learning being implemented on the spot by schools nationwide for the first time, the largest districts are buying up inventory in huge numbers. The Chicago Public Schools is in the process of purchasing 37,000 new devices. In Los Angeles, district officials bought Chromebook-like laptops to address an estimated shortage of 150,000 take-home computers for students. And district officials in New York City, home to the largest school system in the country, moved quickly in recent weeks to secure 300,000 new iPads. The first batch of 25,000 iPads was delivered to low-income students last week. Another 50,000 tablets will be delivered by Apple and T-Mobile this week and every week after. Meanwhile, some smaller and rural districts are having problems getting orders fulfilled. The resulting logjam for mobile devices that some school officials are experiencing is unprecedented. School District of Pike Township in Indiana, just outside of Indianapolis, needs about 950 devices to fill an equity gap now that more students will need to take home computers to complete lessons. The district placed an order during the first week of March for the new Chromebooks, as they are replacement for older laptops currently wired in carts at school. They said they can't get a vendor to commit to a delivery date because of supply issues caused by the coronavirus. Comparing the lack of Chromebook stock to another product shortage afflicting masses during the COVID-19 pandemic is like toilet paper. It feels like there's not a Chromebook to be found. Normally, sales for K-12 devices peak in the second and third quarters when school district officials attend education tech trade shows and begin to finalize their district budgets, buying the bulk of their gadgets between April and July to have ready for the start of a new school year. In this case, the market ramped up 100% overnight. While the supply chain in China is making progress toward recovery, there is still a general shortage of device components, such as panels, displays, circuit boards that is expected to persist through at least May and maybe longer. As a result, the K-12 is largely going to struggle to fulfill their needs through much of the second quarter of the year, noting that increased demand for Chromebooks and other devices driven by work-from-home bump should slow if fears of a recession continue, but these school district orders are going to keep coming. Entering 2020 for the K-12 sector was more abundant than in previous years, but that's now running extremely low, and there's just no units to replace the inventory with right now. It is noted some of the larger districts have been able to fulfill technology needs, and that's due in large part to being able to flex procurement muscle via purchasing power. In addition, some of the biggest states, like New York and California in particular, were among the first hit hard by the coronavirus, requiring district officials to react earlier. The larger districts have more money to throw around, so there's a bit of a bidding war going on. The more purchasing power you have, the more likely you're able to fulfill those units. School administrators have to prepare for unplanned expenses stemming from new technology purchases caused by the pandemic. Now there's the additional headache of dealing with delays because of demand. Now featuring Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. What IT functions can be done remotely?
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and it's time to talk business. This is where I'm giving you my experience, my current experience, but also my past experience, 30 years of being an IT professional. A question came in, and this question goes like this. What type of IT functions can be done remotely, and what type of IT functions must be office situated? I have been doing remote level access of computers for nearly 20 years. It has been an absolute reward for me to be able to tackle a lot more problems from the comfort of my desk. Safety isn't really the right word. At least it hasn't been up until the last month or so. But comfort, it definitely is. Matter of fact, one of the things that I've enjoyed being able to do is address multiple people's computer issues sitting at my desk at the same time. You may have experienced this before. You may have gone on to a chat session with this tech support company or that tech support company, and they are kind of slow at responding to your chats. You've probably noticed this. That's because they're handling three or four different chats all at the same time, trying to deal with three or four different people who have three or four different computer problems. And it's all multitasking. It's all dealing with a number of different people at the same time. Now, we can do this kind of remote tech support and have been. I've been doing it for nearly 20 years. I can remember the first company that I did it at, and I was already able to remote control my home system from the office before we officially were doing it at the office. What can I say? I'm a nerd. I enjoy leveraging technology to do some of the most amazing things out there. So, yes, the ability for me to sit at my desk and to remote control your system. Let's say you have a computer problem. Most of the computer problems I can deal with via remote. I'm having a problem with my Microsoft Outlook. Can you hit the internet? Oh, yeah. There we go. Go to this website and we'll connect up. Are you having a problem with this or that or the other thing? Whatever software problem it is. And even sometimes some of the hardware issues, because a lot of the configuration of hardware can be done via remote. A lot of it's really configuration, not of the hardware itself, but of how Windows or Mac operating system deals with it. There are applications out there that will allow us to access smartphones or tablets. This is something that's been a wonderful enabler for tech support everywhere. Now, what kind of IT functions, as a general rule, can be done remotely? Well, these days, a lot of the server support is done via remote. It is something that, yes, it's great to be able to sit at your desk where you have a chair instead of going into the server room, which is decidedly a little bit chillier and there is no chair, and you stand up and you type on a keyboard that is, more or less at the right height, unless you are more or less taller or shorter than everybody else, in which case it gets a little bit more uncomfortable. So we have all of these different things that work into the whole arrangement. So if you can sit at your computer and you can do 90% of the work from your desk, you can do that. Do I need more hard drive space? So I access the SAN or the NAS and I just assign more space to the server. And that's easily done. The few things that we have to go in person, that we have to do in person, are things like replacing hard drives. You know, so you may not be familiar with this. In the network environment, in the enterprise world, there are SAN and NAS storage systems. Storage area network, network attached storage. And these are just assemblies of a bunch of hard drives. Well, if one of those goes bad, we have to physically go in there. We pop out the bad one, we put in a good one, we lock it all into place, and then it automatically recovers all of the data. That's a very simplistic view of this, but that's all we have to do. If we have to add more memory to a physical server, or we have to add different things to the systems, we have to check on systems because they're overheating. Yeah, we'll pay attention to that. We will go in and pay a visit to those systems in person. But these days, most network items, most everything that we can do in IT can be done from our armchair, from our nice comfy chair, from our desk. And we can do that on multiple servers at the same time. Especially when we start talking about things like virtualization. VMware is just one big world of virtualization. And Hyper-V is the Microsoft version of it. But those are virtual servers we're dealing with. And because they're virtual servers, not actual physical servers, all of that's done via remote anyway. Yeah, there's been a lot. It used to be physical servers in cold server rooms, and we'd have guys in there. I remember one server room we worked at, there was a parka. When you walked in the front door, there was a parka right there. And yeah, more than once I would see people wearing that thing as they were freezing in there. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Remotely troubleshoot a PC with Windows Quick Assist. There are plenty of times when in-person troubleshooting isn't possible. Maybe you and another person live in different cities, or you work in different offices, or the world is on lockdown due to a pandemic. Whatever the case may be, a useful Windows 10 feature can help you remotely lend a hand to your coworkers, friends, and family. Quick Assist is a Windows 10 application that enables two people to share a device over remote connection by allowing a trusted friend, family member, or Microsoft support person, for that matter, to access your computer. You can troubleshoot, diagnose technological issues, and receive instructions on your computer. The communications of one computer to the other is via the Microsoft Cloud, in which both are running Windows 10 and have a Microsoft account. And if you don't have one, you can create one. Both users must be signed in as administrators to be able to offer and receive technical assistance using the Quick Assist remote desktop app. It's called Windows Quick Assist, and you can use it to access another user's desktop over the internet to walk them through any issues they may be having with their computer. The tool offers several helpful features, including the ability to highlight specific parts of the other user's screen or even manage their system settings. To use Quick Assist, both people need to have Windows 10 installed on their desktop or laptops, and both devices must be turned on and connected to the internet. They don't have to be on the same network, however. As long as you meet those criteria, you can connect to the other person's PC with Windows Quick Assist using the following steps. Search for Quick Assist from the Windows Start menu or Taskbar Search field. Click Windows Assist to run the program. Select Give Assistance. Follow the on-screen instructions to sign into your Microsoft account or create one if you don't have one. Once you've signed in, you'll be given a 6-digit access code, and keep this handy for the next session. Next, on the other person's PC, have them search for and run Quick Assist just as you did in the machine that's giving assist. Once Quick Assist is open, have the person click Get Assistance and have them type in the 6-digit access code you'll provide them, then click Submit. Have them click Allow once prompted. In my testing, you're given 10 minutes to initiate the connect between computers. If everything went well, you should now have access to the other person's desktop through Quick Assist. From here, you as the helper can click around the other person's PC and do what needs to be done. Both users also have a few Quick Assist specific actions available within the app. You can annotate. This feature allows you to draw on the other person's desktop. This is useful for jotting down notes or highlighting parts of the screen you want to bring their attention to. Any annotation you make will be removed when Quick Assist is closed. Pause. Temporarily pauses Quick Assist. Click this again to resume. Restart. Reboots the other person's PC, but doesn't disable Quick Assist. The helper will regain access to the other person's desktop after their machine reboots. Stop. This ends the Quick Assist session. You can also close the Quick Assist window at any time to end Quick Assist. Task Manager lets the helper open the other person's Task Manager. This is useful if you need to check what programs they're running and don't want to explain what Control-Alt-Delete means. When you're ready to close Windows Quick Assist, simply press Stop and or close the app window to end the connection. Note that you'll need to repeat the above steps if you wish to reconnect in the future. Microsoft rolled out this remote desktop app, allowing Windows 10 users to provide remote technical assistance to those in need. Quick Assist Remote Desktop app is available with Windows build number 14385. That's Windows 10 build 14385. The app is perhaps the easiest remote desktop app to use, as it offers only two options. Users can ask for help or provide assistance to the other user. In order to establish connection, a common code used by both users is necessary, just as TeamViewer's case. Another interesting and extremely useful feature is the support for styluses, which can come in handy when offering explanations. Surface Book or Surface Pro 4 users can easily connect to another user's computer, provide assistance, and add annotations on screen at the same time. Have fun if you check. The Quick Access app finally eliminates the need to use third-party apps for remote desktop connections. The app has been exclusively created for Windows 10, so it's fully optimized for Windows' latest operating system. You now have a new tool to assist those who need help. It's back to the future with a smaller smartphone. The word small is a relative term. Apple's new iPhone SE 2 has increased in size dramatically over the past few years. But this year, it feels like the idea of a small phone that you actually want to use as a primary device is a thing of the past. Last week, Apple announced the second generation iPhone SE, which is basically an iPhone 8 with the processor of the iPhone 11. It officially replaces the first iPhone SE, which Apple released back in 2016, and they stopped selling it sometime in 2018. The new SE shares the original attractive price point and fingerprint scanning home button, but is now a significantly larger device. It has a 4.7-inch display compared to the original 4-inch screen, and the entire phone is almost 30% bigger. The new SE is smaller than the rest of Apple's current lineup. The trend is also reflected in Samsung's recent Galaxy S20 lineup. The smallest model available has a 6.2-inch screen and is undeniably a big phone. The step-up S20 Plus and the S20 Ultra go out of their way to push the boundaries of how big a phone can be. A year ago, Samsung released the 5.8-inch S10e alongside the bigger phones, but this year there's no such option. Perhaps the worst offender of calling a big phone small is OnePlus. The company introduced its new OnePlus 8 as having a compact design, despite the fact that it has a 6.55-inch screen and is bigger than most other phones on the market right now. The OnePlus 8 may be slightly smaller than the even larger OnePlus 8 Pro, a phone that measures over 6 inches tall, almost 3 inches wide, and they call that a compact. And if you're a fan of bigger phones and all of the benefits they bring, such as more immersive screens, bigger batteries, and more wireless radios, you may think the idea of a small phone is quaint in the middle of 2020. After all, your phone is likely to be your most used computer and the most important gadget in your life. But if you see someone who has trouble using today's phones in one hand and keeping them in the pocket of your favorite jeans, you know that the 4.7-inch iPhone SE 2 is still a big phone, regardless of the fact that Apple referred to it as having a small 4.7-inch design in the hype video introducing the product. It's easy to see why Apple went with a larger design for the new model. The company claims this size is the most popular iPhone ever released, and on a technical level, it's easier to fit components into a larger frame than a smaller one. Plus, Apple has years of experience with this basic form factor going all the way back to the iPhone 6. In fact, if you cast your memory back to that time, you might recall that the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus were worldwide blockbusters because Apple was finally meeting demands for big phones. What was big in 2014 is now small in 2020. We can talk about those industry trends for days, but all that would be little consolation for those that just want a smaller phone. And by the way, you could see that the trend of using the iPhones and the Android phones in cars. It used to be you spend about $2,000 extra to get the navigation package in any new car, in other words, GPS. Now, in place of the GPS, they are now using smartphones because they are regularly updated, unlike the GPS in the car that's updated and you have to pay for it, and it's not updated on a daily basis. Presenting All Hands on Tech with Marty Winston. 1 out of 4 channel memory.
You'll get a different answer to this question depending on who you are and depending on your level of experience. Do you think computers are complicated or simple? Well, in a way, they're both. Over the years, you know, make that decades. Anyway, over all that time, they shifted from making you add a lot of the things that you used, and those functions migrated into the motherboard. Motherboards and the chipsets they used, their embedded electronics, got a lot more sophisticated. Many computers in use today don't need separate graphics cards, don't need separate sound cards, don't need separate disk interface cards, don't need separate USB port cards, and don't need separate network interface cards. Those all used to be separate things that you either had to buy separately and add yourself, or that were included in the specific model of computer you bought. They were kind of like cars. There were the basic models and the special packages that the factories or dealer groups would put together. In cars, it's packages. In computers, it's bundles. And listen, if you don't remember those days, seriously, congratulate yourself. At PC Retailers and VARs, that's an old term meaning value-added resellers, V-A-R, VAR. Well, anyway, there was a steady and lucrative business in what you might think of as cafeteria design PCs. Oh, give me one of those and two of those, and I'd like that one extra dark. Well, you might be guided by a salesperson, or you could be left on your own. Either way, the process let you custom tailor what would be in your PC. For a while, it was kind of a heyday for a lot of companies, only some of which are still around. PC builds for gamers and PC builds for people doing video production represented most retail-bought custom builds and most of the BYO, that's short for build your own, most of the BYO sales of computers. The motherboard companies paid attention. The CPU makers like Intel and AMD paid attention. Not just for the overclocked street machine gamer trends, but also for how the same systems might be deployed as special function servers on networks. Not all those roles needed server-grade guts with multiple Xeon processors and so on. Xeon, by the way, is the name of a processor line from Intel that was born to handle cooperative multiprocessing. And again, if your life never exposed you to that, congratulations. The PC Central processor, in fact all processor designs, kept evolving into smaller and smaller size scales, smaller geometries. The shorter the distance between two data handling points inside a CPU, the less time it took for electronic signals, even moving at the speed of light, to get there. Tiny improvements in those distances multiplied by the huge and growing numbers of active devices inside a CPU, well, that added up to a tangible difference in real-world performance. So the CPUs themselves, though not growing much in physical size, exploded in their complexity and sophistication. More functions could be handled within the CPU, which eliminated many delays and sped things up. Communications between the CPU and motherboard chipsets also improved. Much like those Xeon processors, standard PC CPUs were also increasingly designed for multiple processors working cooperatively. And can you guess? This was happening inside the CPU itself. One CPU could have multiple cores, where each core is a separate internal processor. And if you think you may have heard that term before, that could be because of Intel's Core series of CPUs, the Core i3, Core i5, Core i7, and Core i9, for example. Because they could intercommunicate within the CPU itself, these multi-core designs can be extremely efficient with high speed, minimal energy costs, and very minimal losses through heating. It's good stuff. By the way, nothing you need to get to understand in detail, but in contemporary CPUs, each of those cores can handle two separate processing chores called threads, two at the same time. So, for example, a Core i9 CPU might have 10 cores and 20 threads. That opens up a lot of potential to divide and conquer many processing tasks, letting them run at the same time. Our core today is memory, but please indulge one short tangent before we dig into that. You just learned about cores and threads in the CPU. You may also like to understand lanes, which are the data transfer paths between the CPU and many motherboard assets like graphics cards, drives, high-speed network connections, the really fast new USB ports, and so on. Just as each CPU may have a large but limited number of cores, it will support some large but limited number of lanes. The newest CPU and motherboard that we have here supports 44 lanes. That's a lot. The PCI Express slots on the motherboard support PCI Standard 3.0 faster than before. 4 is out now too. The longest slots are 16X. It also has 4X, 2X, and 1X slots. And sometimes, putting something into one specific slot can deny you the use of another slot or port connection somewhere else. It's all documented. So gamers, for example, are likely to devote their highest slot priorities to connecting multiple graphics cards. You don't have to remember any of that. It's just part of the picture of how a multi-core CPU works with other things in a system by hooking up through the motherboard. Our focus needs to move to memory, but it also needed the context of how the CPU became a beast with many heads that, using those heads, now moves faster than before. It's a terrible visual, but it's a good metaphor. In the early and often homebrew days of personal computers, the CPU was a single processor and it would communicate with whatever memory was there over the data path that its design provided, usually one byte at a time, one 8-bit byte. It was about as fast as commuting over a deer path in a forest. CPUs evolved to use a wider data path. Think in terms of 64 bits at a time. Much more serviceable. Think of that as an upgrade from a deer path to, a country dirt road or a side street. IBM's mainframes of the long time ago 1960s, like some of the System 360 models, added a second set of memory with a duplicate path to the CPU. That's two-channel memory, and it shuttles twice as much data. Think of it as a two-lane city street. More recently, earlier in this century, love saying that, we saw systems using three-channel memory. Think of that as a three-lane beltway that could handle three times as much traffic as a one-lane street. As of about a decade ago, the CPUs in PCs were set up to handle 4-channel memory, a 4-lane data superhighway inside your PC with 4 sets of memory transactions happening at the same time, meaning they get done with what they're doing a lot faster. Well, theoretically. The reality. The reality is that a lot of users who believe they're running their 4-channel memory in a true 4-channel mode really aren't. They're not on that 4-lane superhighway, or they are, and 3 of the lanes are closed. The reason is, well, the technological reasons are too deep geek to bore you with here, but it all comes down to 4-channel memory implementations being very, very picky, even finicky. All the memory and all the channels, each module in every slot in my motherboard, either the correct 4 memory slots or all 8 memory sockets, all of those memory modules must be identical, the same size, the same speed, the same timing characteristics. If they're not, you get a good-sized footprint of memory, but all stacked up in one channel. Just as you might expect from our street-smart metaphors, that traffic can get all backed up and bottlenecked. So what isn't working out? Mostly it's the matching. It isn't enough that all the memory is DDR4 memory. Systems that can support 4-channel memory only have DDR4 memory slots or sockets. But within DDR4 memory, there's nothing special that makes a memory module 4-channel compatible. It all is. So, more accurately, it means that DDR4 memory is not incompatible. Now, if you want to set up 4-channel memory, you're going to be using either 4 or 8 DDR4 memory modules, or as some of us call them, sticks. All 4 or all 8 have to be the same capacity, the same size. The biggest modules, the biggest capacity that our motherboard can handle in each module is 16 gigabytes. So 4 of that size mean 64 gigabytes total memory on the system. 8 of that size, well, that cranks it up to 128 gigabytes if we populate all 8 slots with 16 gig memory. It's just multiplication. If 4-channel is working, that's either 16 or 32 gigabytes per channel. Well, many notebooks operate with a total of 12 or 16 gigabytes, so 16 or 32, that's nothing to sneeze at, especially working side by side, times 4. But having the same size, again, having the same size in and of itself is not enough. They also have to be the same speed. The motherboard here wants to see each one at least 2666 megahertz. They can be faster, but they all have to be the same. And then there's the timing, which might read something like 16-18-18. And the voltage, all of that has to be identical. Here's the issue. All those CPU cores, all those cores inside the one CPU chip, they all clock in lockstep. And if a single stick of memory is dancing to a different drummer, there's no way to individually adjust them. So, either the 4 channels are in every way identical, or the system never leaves single channel mode. Now, some of the memory houses, the brands in memory, do offer 4-module and 8-module matched memory kits for 4-channel systems. They are at a premium price. For 8 matched modules at 2666 megahertz or more, budget between $700 and $1,600. By the way, even when you perfectly match memory, populating the wrong group of memory sockets can also thwart your wishes for 4-channel. Read the manual, the motherboard manual. Read it. If you make it into 4 channels, you don't just get warp speed CPU to memory mind melding. You also get a computer that will keep working longer because of reduced wear and tear and aging on hard drives, on power supplies, on the CPU, and on motherboard electronics. You'll kick those things up another notch if you let the throughput boost of the 4-channel memory satisfy your need to speed and you elect not to overclock your system. Overclocking cuts its life expectancy short. Take the throughput boost of 4-channel memory and ignore the overclocking. Now next time, with the seasonal weather changing, with sheltering at home relaxing, and with all of us slowly getting back to life, tech products and choices can take on new relevance. call that segment Think Again. And just in case you think it's one you're okay missing, well, think again.
Thank you, Marty. At this point in the program, we generally make public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical assistance, the club members are more than happy to assist. All these club meetings are open, free to the public. However, at this time, because of the coronavirus stay-at-home order, all the computer clubs have canceled their meetings. You can go to our website, pcradioshow.org. We have the computer clubs listed, and if you go to the website, you can check when they do schedule a meeting, and some of them are holding remote virtual meetings, so you may be interested in following up on them. If you are listening to this program live streaming on the internet, at the end of this program at 7 p.m., open your windows and show your appreciation for these workers. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups and heed the guidance of staying at home. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and remember, keep 6 feet apart. And until we meet again, same time, same station next week. In a few minutes at 7 p.m., join your neighbors and shout out into the streets your thanks and support for all the first responders, the nurses, the doctors, the EMT workers, the firemen, the policemen, the workers who maintain the supply of food, and all those who have to remain on the job to maintain essential services. Signing off now with what has become the signature music of New York City.
Start spreading the news. You're leaving today. Tell him, Frank.
I want to be a part of it. New York, New York.
Your vagabond shoes, they are longing to stray
and step around the heart of it. New York, New York. I want to wake up in that city that doesn't sleep
and find your king of the hill, top of the heap. Your small town blues, they're melting away.
I'm gonna make a brand new start of it in old New York.
You always make it there. You make it
up to you, New York, New York.
Da 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 da
da da da da da da da da da. In New York, New York. I want to wake up in that city that doesn't sleep. The list,
you bet. And I'm the one king of the hill.
Here's a little town roads. They have all melted away, and I'm gonna make a brand start of it right there in old New York. come through.